But welcome. You're welcome to call. Anybody's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Thank you, David. Glad to be back.
Well, we'll start out here by talking, doing our seasonal mention of the flu vaccine, which we're now coming to the time that people should be thinking about flu shots.
That's exactly right.
Earlier in the year, when there was some talk about the fact that the company that was producing the vaccine was having some sort of difficulty, and there might be some question about whether there would be enough vaccine available for everybody who wanted to get it, or also there was some question about, well, when would it be? Would it be here at the time that we really need it? From what you've been able to see, does it seem to be that there's plenty, and anybody who wants to get a flu shot can get it?
Locally, I don't think it's going to be a problem. I know the Carle organization has received its full shipment of flu vaccine and is gearing up to do both office-based and community-based flu clinics. And I don't think there's going to be a shortage of vaccine. There was predicted to possibly be a shortage or a delay in receiving the vaccine. And the other concern was the fact that some of the recent national organizations had broadened the recommendations for who should receive a flu shot, and this was going to increase the number of people who might be eligible. So currently, they're sort of going easy on the recommendations for expanding flu shot coverage, but still, certainly individuals over the age of 65 or anyone with a chronic heart or lung disease should be considered an appropriate candidate, and they should definitely check with their physician about getting a flu shot.
Mm. And beyond that, then, I guess we also always say anybody who doesn't really want to get the flu may get a shot. And
correct. And that's where one of the recommendations had come from, was the fact that even if there isn't increased mortality from influenza, there's a great deal of morbidity, time lost from work, decreased economic production, those sorts of things. So some of the organizations had recommended that everyone over the age of 50 be immunized with a yearly flu shot. This would greatly expand the number of people who would be eligible for a flu shot, and there was concerns this year that there simply wouldn't be enough vaccine to cover everybody if they followed those recommendations. But certainly any individual who wants to avoid coming down with influenza, and a flu shot would be a very reasonable thing to do.
Hmm. So would you also suggest that in addition to, we talked about those people who were sort of on the standard list, we recommend that folks, if you have these sorts of conditions, that you think about having a flu shot. If you are not in those categories, however, if you live with somebody who is, would you also suggest that it's probably a good idea for the household for everybody to be immunized, because then
it reduces the risk of the individual who is at higher risk for those illnesses. I think that is correct.
Mm-hmm. These vaccines are made somehow in the eggs are used in the manufacture of the
correct.
Vaccine.
The virus is incubated in an egg product, and consequently, individuals who really do have a true egg allergy really shouldn't take a flu shot.
Mm-hmm. Is there some alternative for those folks, or are they just out of luck?
They're sort of out of luck. But again, if enough individuals around them are immunized, you gain the benefit of what's referred to as herd immunity. Cattle operators and other agronomists have known for years that you didn't have to vaccinate the entire herd. You only had to vaccinate 75 to 80%, therefore decreasing the likelihood of transmission of the illness through the rest of the herd. So basically, if a non-immunized individual is surrounded by immunized individuals, it makes it very unlikely that they're going to pick up the illness because they're not coming in contact with anybody who has it.
Mm-hmm. Something that I guess we've noticed in our household that's kind of interesting is that, you know, here we've got two adults that live very close together all the time, and yet it seems often to be the case that if one of us gets sick, the other one doesn't. Now you would think, well, you know, the chances should be maximal of infecting the person that you live with, which makes me start to wonder, is it really more likely that you might catch a cold or flu based on casual contact than you would from those people that are really that close to you?
Well, David, I'm sorry to hear that your relationship is that distant with your significant
other.
Well,
it's, you know, it's been 13, 14, 15 years now, so.
But you're exactly right. In most instances, you probably share some common immunity. The kinds of bugs that you've had have already been shared with your spouse and vice versa, and you've probably acquired some immunity there. And it's the new bugs that you pick up outside of your own household, and that can be, you know, virtually anywhere. As children congregate in crowded schools, office workers congregate in buildings that increasingly are sealed against the outside weather, as people start to do their holiday shopping in the malls, there's a great deal of potential to come in contact with the virus that is normally carried in respiratory droplets, but that can be then deposited on, you know, virtually any surface, including doorknobs and those sorts of things. This comes back to the standard recommendation of frequent hand washing to try and prevent the transmission of illness, and essentially keeping your hands away from your face is another good way of trying to minimize the chance that you'll essentially inoculate yourself with something on your hands.
Yeah. I've certainly seen reports where people have gone out into the world with swabs and just rub them on tabletops, on doorknobs, going into public restrooms, you know, or even going into someone's house, mm-hmm. that would seem to be a, you know, on the average, a reasonably good housekeeper. So if you start going around and you start culturing various surfaces, then you go back in the laboratory and you put that in that little medium where they grow, you give them a couple of days, suddenly you start to see, whoa, the world around us is just
not sterile.
Loaded. No, it's not sterile. It's just loaded with germs. But I sort of wonder if you think of something like a tabletop. Here we're sitting in this tabletop, and it's got some, I don't know if it's formica or some kind of hard, non-absorbent surface. How long would, say a cold virus, if we smeared some of that here on the tabletop and let it sit there, how long is it going to live sitting on this plastic tabletop?
For a few hours, especially if the environment's moist.
Okay.
And consequently, you can indeed pick up viruses from things like doorknobs and telephone hand receivers and other objects that people commonly utilize and share but don't necessarily clean in between. And while, you know, some moms are a little overly protective of their kids in terms of trying to reduce their exposure to the natural bacteria and viruses that are in the world, there is some benefit to regularly cleaning off some of these common surfaces, especially during the times of year when more of these illnesses are common.
Our guest this morning here in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he's here for the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have questions about health, can be just about anything, give us a call, and he'll do his best to help you out, give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. From time to time, things have been embraced as preventatives for colds. I guess there's probably still a lot of people who believe in vitamin C, big doses of vitamin C. Zinc, people have talked about. Zinc is supposed to help. There are people who believe in echinacea, right. Maybe other sorts of herbal items. Is there anything better than just anecdotal evidence that any of these things do much good?
I'm not yet aware of anything that would be considered clinically significant that would sort of uniformly be protective for everyone. The things that you mentioned, vitamin C, zinc, echinacea, have all been touted as potentially being ways to prevent colds, but I haven't seen any good hard data that would make it in my opinion, at least a standard form of therapy. It probably falls into the category of it's not going to hurt you to try it, but in most instances, the best thing that you can do is try and avoid it in the first place.
Okay. We have a caller in Central Illinois, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Yes. I would like to find out what is the danger of consuming, like there's a shelf life on frozen beef, frozen pork, frozen cured meat. I think cured meat is probably 6 months, maybe pork is also 6 months, and beef is a year. What is the danger in eating meat that's been in the freezer longer than that length of time?
I'm not sure that I know specifically. Most of the time, the recommendations regarding food relate to things that become thawed and therefore allow bacteria to grow. I'm not sure I know specifically what the health dangers are related to food that's been frozen excessively long.
I guess we don't have an answer to your question.
Okay, thank you.
You might try, no matter, depending on where you live, you might try to call the extension person near you. They might have an answer for you.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, welcome, though. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I don't think we've ever gotten a question on frozen food before.
No. And it just goes to show that there are all aspects of medicine that still remain to have questions answered.
Well, in any case, if you have questions for our guest, Jeff Swearingen, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. So aside from just the standard advice we gave before about trying to stay as healthy as you can, you know, eat right and get rest and wash your hands frequently and don't touch your face if you can possibly avoid it. That's about it. That's what we can say.
Right. There are currently a fair number of trials being undertaken in an attempt to find ways to sort of immunize individuals against some of the more common cold viruses, and they're experimenting with vaccines that would be used intranasally. You'd basically inhale them into the surfaces that are most likely to be attacked by cold viruses. And some of these have shown some initial promise, but the difficulty is that there are simply so many different types of viruses that produce similar upper respiratory symptoms that it's just very time-consuming to nail them all down and get them into a vaccine that would be helpful for everyone.
It strikes me that while colds can be a nuisance, and maybe if you have a bad cold for a couple of days, you might feel bad. And I guess allowing for the fact that it is possible that you can then go on to things like sinus infections and bronchitis and pneumonia and bad stuff. Having said that, given the fact that colds are sort of they come and go, you sort of wonder, would it really be worth all the trouble that it would take to develop a vaccine? Even if you could develop a vaccine, would we decide that the common cold was enough of a problem so that we would vaccinate people against it?
I think you would have to look at the sort of economic impact of the benefits of a vaccine versus the amount of time that people lose from school and work if indeed their cold is bad enough to prevent them from going to school or work. From strictly that standpoint, it may indeed turn out to be really quite efficacious to go ahead and vaccinate people just to minimize the amount of time that they lose from their regular activities. From the standpoint of just general medical complications, probably not. Most of us indeed survive our colds. We're just sort of miserable in the meantime. There are a few folks who go on and develop other problems, and certainly if your symptoms are persisting more than a week and are worsening, that's probably time to go and see your physician to find out if indeed there's a secondary problem developing as well. But as a general rule, if it sort of comes and goes over the course of a week, you probably survived it on your own.
Next caller is local here in Champaign, line 1. Hello.
Hi. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
I've got something I've been meaning to call in to various of David's guests, and I never had a chance, so you're the lucky guest this morning.
I hope I do better than on the first one.
Every year, starting this time and lasting through until April, I have quite a bad problem with splitting cuticles. And maybe it's just a matter of course, but it really is quite painful. And I'm just wondering, I've never actually asked a doctor about this. Is that indicative of any kind of, anything at all? Is it just something that I have to live with? Should I be checked for anything? Because it's, it involves about 3 or 4 fingers on each hand and lasts all winter long.
To the extent that it's seasonal and then goes away, it's probably not a serious underlying disorder of any sort. Given the time frame that you describe, it's most likely related to the drying of the skin that is much more common during the winter months and could probably be addressed with avoidance of soap and water, the addition of a good moisturizer, and in terms of some of the inflammatory changes, perhaps some topical hydrocortisone. And the other aspect of that is then, what are you doing with the nails? You have to be careful that you're not, pushing or probing the nail bed, with any of the sort of nail trimming instruments. But assuming that you're not mechanically irritating this, the most likely explanation, given the seasonal nature of what you described, is probably related to changes in moisture of the skin.
Yeah, and for the past couple years, I've started every night when I go to bed, put on a lotion and with a soft cotton glove.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a bedtime routine, and that really doesn't seem to have much effect at all. And I do take a multivitamin regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I've even started wearing gloves when I do the dishes because that was an obvious thing that
right.
I thought would help.
The soap and water exposure is definitely something that needs to be avoided.
Yeah. But other than that, it because it is seasonal, doesn't seem to be indicating any greater health concern.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222. WILO. Something I guess I was interested in going back for a second, and when we were back, when we were talking about dealing with the winter illnesses, colds in particular. What sort of benefit is there, particularly for children? And I guess I think of this as being something that was more popular when I was a kid. Maybe it still is. Of room atomizers. That is this idea that. Because the air is dry mm-hmm. in the wintertime, that there might be some benefit to trying to put back some moisture into the air. Is that indeed something where there is some benefit, particularly for small children?
Not necessarily particularly for children, but in general, improving the atmospheric humidity is a way of trying to prevent the lining of the nose and the sinuses from drying out, which is fairly common, especially in buildings with forced air heat in the winter where the air does get particularly dry. When the lining of the nose and the sinuses becomes dry, it cracks. It allows bacteria then to enter underneath the surface, and that can be a setup for infection. But there are a variety of ways that you can basically improve the humidification of the mucous membranes of the upper respiratory tract, the most important one of which is simply to increase your water intake. In the summer, when people are sort of hot and sweaty and thirsty, they just sort of naturally try to boost their fluid intake. When it's sort of cold, people don't think about as much increasing their fluid intake, but in fact they really need to keep their fluids up just as much in the winter as they do in the summer, and quite a few people actually back off on their own fluid intake. So sort of the world's best humidifier is simply to get more water into your own system via drinking. The other aspect of sort of loosening secretions in the nose and the sinuses, you can do that by just standing in the shower for 15, 20 minutes. That often works as a nice little sort of hot sauna kind of effect on the nasal mucosa, and that's often helpful. The use of a humidifier in a child's room, I think, is fine. You basically need to make sure that you change the water regularly and clean any of the component parts. Basically, stagnant water sitting around for any length of time becomes a place where bacteria can grow, and so you don't obviously want to be spraying an aerosolized mixture of bacteria into the air. But as long as they're kept clean and the water changed regularly, I think that's fine, but isn't all that critical in terms of the health of children as compared to adults. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you mentioned relative to children in terms of they too are often candidates for flu shots in the fall. A fair number of kids do have asthmatic type conditions, and in many instances, viral respiratory illnesses are a trigger for their asthma. So I think children who have any of these asthmatic tendencies would be a good candidate for a flu shot, as well as the rest of their family members.
Okay. Midway through year, certainly time for other questions. If you'd like to talk with our guest, Jeff Swearingen, you can give us a call. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic and is here every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he deals with people of all ages in his practice, with grown-ups, with kids, and sees a lot of different things throughout the course of the day and the week. So if you have a question, you can give us a call.
One additional thing that maybe the listeners aren't quite familiar with yet, but in the last couple of years, a recommendation has come out that pregnant women in the second and third trimester are candidates now for flu shots. So that may not be commonly known yet, but they do fall into a category now that are routinely recommended to get flu shots in the fall if they're in their second or third trimester.
So what's the issue if they should get the flu? Just that they'll feel bad, or does that pose some sort of...
It's actually felt to, on a statistical basis, be associated with a higher morbidity and mortality for mom and baby if a pregnant woman comes down with a bad case of influenza.
Okay.
Now, on a statistical basis, you have to immunize a large number of pregnant women to prevent those complications, but it is indeed something that is preventable.
What about pneumonia vaccine? That's something that people also might be thinking about this time of year. We don't. It's not the kind of thing that we give as widely as flu shots. And
but
if I remember right,
fact,
you only have
be.
One. Okay. Well, who? Let's do that. Who would you recommend should have that?
The pneumococcal vaccine has actually been around for quite a long time and is sort of woefully underused on a national level. It, like the flu shot, is sort of automatically recommended for everyone over the age of 65. So if you're over 65 and haven't had a pneumonia vaccination, you should get one. If you're under the age of 65, but again are at high risk for complications related to respiratory illnesses, you would again be a candidate for, in addition to a flu shot, a pneumonia vaccination as well. Now, if your pneumonia vaccination is given under the age of 65, it probably needs to be updated later, usually in 5 to 8 years. People are saying there's not good concurrence yet on exactly how long that's supposedly going to be good for, but as a general rule, it's given once after the age of 65. If you're in a high-risk group after the age of 65, it may indeed be repeated. If you have bad underlying heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, your doctor may recommend that it get boosted in 5 to 8 years. But certainly the vaccination is safe, effective, and has definitely been shown to significantly reduce morbidity and mortality in high-risk populations. Now, one step off of that is the fact that there has just recently become available a pediatric pneumococcal vaccine that's effective under the age of 2. This is a relatively new vaccine, and there are some recommendations regarding how it's to be administered. And if you're not familiar with this for your kids, you might want to talk to your family doctor or pediatrician about this, because it is a new vaccine. It's not yet a vaccine that's required for school, so it's certainly not mandatory. But there are some suggestions that the reduction of pneumococcal illness in kids under the age of 2 could potentially prevent some fairly serious types of illness, not just the typical kids' ear infections, which are often due to pneumococcal disease, but also pneumonias, certain types of meningitis, and certain types of sepsis where bacteria get into the bloodstream.
For children, as all parents know, I guess, because we've been kids, we sort of know too, there is a recommended series of immunizations.
And it keeps growing.
I'm not sure when the latest of these things. I guess there probably are some things that you renew when people are in their teen.
Currently, the only standard immunization that's routinely boosted is a tetanus booster, which essentially, as a kid, you got with your ninth grade physical, and then as an adult, we're supposed to get boosted about every 10 years. There are going to be some questions about some of the newer vaccines. One that comes to mind is the vaccination for chickenpox. The vaccine itself hasn't been around 50 years, so there's no way to know for sure how long the immunity from that is going to last. And it may turn out in the future that that's something that kids who are immunized will need boosters for. But right now, there aren't any current recommendations for that.
That I guess was the question that I was going for. You know, once you get out of your childhood, when you're getting all these shots periodically, and you get to be a grown up, whether there is anything that you do need to keep current on. And it sounds like the answer is tetanus. That's the one thing that,
that's
as
correct.
An adult, periodically, I guess every 10 years,
right.
You probably should have.
Right. Now, adults may not have been immunized as a child for some of the illnesses that kids currently are being immunized for. Mm-hmm. And one of those that they may still benefit from would be the hepatitis B immunization. Now, if you are in any type of line of work where you have the potential to come in contact with blood or body fluids, if you're a policeman, a fireman, a paramedic, teachers, daycare workers, these are situations where if as an adult you haven't been immunized for hepatitis B, you might want to, again, talk to your physician about the benefits of that.
Hmm. Again, we're here open to whatever questions you might have. Healthcare, that's the topic. It's our monthly or every other month Talk to the Family Doctor show with Jeff Swearingen from Carl Clinic. You have a question, you can call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455, toll free 800-222-WILL. Just now, since we were talking about tetanus here, maybe it would be interesting to talk about that for a second. And again, as I think back to my childhood, tetanus was something you got from stepping on rusty nails.
Right. It's actually an organism that lives in soil. So it's sort of out there ubiquitously, and it will basically survive sort of in spore form in the earth and then sort of flower once it reaches a very favorable environment like the inside of a wound. And consequently, if you're inoculated with the tetanus bacterium through an open wound, then you want to make sure that your tetanus booster is up to date so that your body has the proper degree of immunity to resist that infection.
So that's the issue, particularly if you have not just a scratch, but if you have a kind of a puncture wound,
right.
And you get this outside, it's not necessarily rusty nails that are really the issue, but the fact that it's there, and so you want to be concerned about certainly trying to disinfect that or keep it clean, mm-hmm. And then you might want to review your your status for tetanus.
And very commonly we receive phone calls at the office. You know, somebody says just that, I stepped on something or I got a cut and I need to know when my last tetanus booster was.
Okay. We have several callers here. We'll go first to, line number four. Thank you very much, Brian, in Arcola. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I was wanting to ask the possibility. I mean, I didn't know what I'm doing with this. I wake up in the early morning with a headache that started during the night, and then I do have, throat discharge, not huge amounts, but there is blood in there. And it just happens basically on the headache nights. And so I didn't know whether I'm not doing anything while I'm sleeping, so I didn't know whether headaches were, blood pressure doesn't go up when you're sleeping or anything.
Well, actually, your blood pressure does fluctuate in its highest or earliest in the morning. To sort of skip to the bottom here, anything that's associated with a bloody discharge is not normal.
Mm-hmm.
And if that hasn't been attended to by your physician, you need to go in and make him or her aware of that, because there isn't any way that we can tell you that any sort of bloody discharge is a normal process.
But it only happens when you have a headache. So if you go in and you say, I have this, but, they can't do any little testing or anything like that.
At the very least, a good examination of your nose, throat, sinuses to exclude anything that's in there and bleeding needs to be done. The workup for headache is quite extensive, and the two may or may not be related. But anything that's recurrent, if this is happening, over and over, and is associated with the blood, needs to be evaluated.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to next to hear an Urbana caller, line number two. Hello.
I have not an answer, but I have a home remedy about cuticles. I see so many people and mostly children who have the cuticles almost up half to the nail. If they push the cuticles back whenever they wash their hands or bathe with a towel so that it loosens around the nail, they won't have this feathering. It will be painful at the beginning, but later it's fine. My mother always told us as children, push your cuticles back. Otherwise, you have this feathery, and then you start chewing on it and pulling them back, and it gets bleeding and it hurts. It has helped me, and it helped all my family. So maybe that will help the person who called in.
Okay.
We'll pass that
thank
along.
You.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to another Urbana person here, line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We have a 14-year-old who is severely handicapped, and inevitably on long weekends like this when he's away from school, we end up with backaches from lifting him and putting him in his chair and all that. When do you know a backache is bad enough to see a doctor?
That's a very good question, because sort of low back pain is one of those extremely common problems that virtually everybody sometime in their life has experienced. The time sequence, if it's directly related to lifting, bending, and you can attribute it to those activities, and it settles down in a couple of days, I probably wouldn't make anything out of that as a problem. Pain that comes on in the absence of a triggering incident is something that probably needs a little bit more attention. Something that doesn't go away in a few days on its own needs attention. The signs and symptoms that make us think of more sort of serious underlying problems, if you have back pain in association with a change in bowel or bladder function, that could be a neurologic problem, and that's potentially serious. If you have pain that radiates down into your leg, either leg, that's associated with numbness, tingling, or weakness, you may be running into, again, some neurological problems that need to be evaluated. The loss of strength in a leg or decrease in reflexes on exam is a problem. But the majority of people's back problems relate to their muscles, and the mechanics of how they lift, and in particular how they position themselves during their daily activities. Sitting is one of the worst activities for backs, and in many instances for people who have a job where they sit or they have a job where they do a lot of bending and lifting, some physical exercises to basically strengthen the low back and the abdominal muscles, if done on a regular basis, is a helpful way of keeping your back in shape. But if you occasionally get a back strain and it responds to rest and a little anti-inflammatory agent, some ice or some heat, and it goes away in a few days, I probably wouldn't attribute anything serious to that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We have, again, about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month, he is here. On a Monday, we do the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Just a kind of an open opportunity for you to ask healthcare questions. As we have said so many times, I've said so many times, we can't promise all questions can be answered because, obviously, over the telephone, you can't really do it because you can't really see the person, but we do offer the opportunity for folks to ask questions. Maybe it's something that's worrying you. You'd like to get a little advice, have a consult here, and then you may want to pursue that with your own doctor. But you can start here with us by giving us a call. Here in Champaign, Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222 WILL or 9455. To Aurora next. So this is line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say something about a colonoscopy. Since the president was wise enough to say that nobody ever died of embarrassment, I think that was a good way of putting it. I wondered, how long does one take? I'm going to have one. How long does it take, a colonoscopy?
The procedure itself will vary in length in many instances simply dependent upon the ease with which the endoscopist can get the scope through your colon. There are basically sort of easy ones and hard ones, and some have a few more twists and turns than others and take a little bit longer. But in general, about a half an hour to 45 minutes. Now, there's going to be some things that change that. One is the anatomy of the individual person. The second is the adequacy of their prep. Basically, the more empty the colon it is, the easier to get through it is and the easier it is to see everything. And then the other aspect is there anything in the colon that then needs further attention? One of the reasons for doing the colonoscopy is to look for small growths called polyps. A number of these polyps are precancerous growths, and those will then be biopsied and removed during the colonoscopy, but that will add considerably more time to your procedure. But the nice thing about it is that in almost all cases, you can remove those polyps at the same time as you're having your colon looked at. Those polyps then are looked at underneath the microscope to see if they're the precancerous type or not. Mm-hmm. If they are, then you need to have the colonoscopy done on a regular basis to make sure that they're not coming back, because they definitely have that tendency to do so. But this has probably been one of the big advances and benefits to sort of modern medicine, in the sense that you can find a precancerous condition, remove it, and prevent it from going on to being a major problem.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope it helps somebody else, too.
I'm sure
Thank
it will.
You. Well, now I guess I should ask what the recommendation is here. Is this one of these deals where it's recommended that everybody past a certain age should do this, or does it have more with looking at risk factors?
Well, in terms of the lower portion of the colon is referred to as the sigmoid colon. And routine sigmoidoscopy, or viewing of the lower third of the colon, is recommended for all individuals over the age of 50 periodically, usually about every 5 years. And the reason for this recommendation from the Cancer Society is that the majority of colon cancers occur in the lower part of the bowel. Okay. So basically, if you're 50 and you haven't had your colon looked at, it's probably time. And if it's been more than 5 years, then it's probably time to do it again. The colonoscopy is a procedure where the entire length of the colon is looked at. Sigmoidoscopy can be done in the office setting without any special anesthesia. It's not necessarily a whole lot of fun, but it only takes about 10 minutes and can be done in the office setting pretty straightforwardly. Colonoscopy, because it becomes increasingly more uncomfortable to go further up into the colon, is done under sedation and therefore is a bigger procedure and requires more preparation and more recovery time. But colonoscopy is basically reserved for individuals who had a positive finding on their sigmoidoscopy and need the rest of their colon looked at, or somebody who already has a family history of colon cancer. So if you have a family history of colon cancer, colonoscopy to look at the entire colon would indeed be recommended. Now, if there are findings, predominantly those precancerous polyps found, then you continue to need regular surveillance.
Okay. Crawfordsville was the next caller. It's line number two. Hello.
This is for the man with the cuticle trouble.
Mm-hmm.
There is a commercial preparation that I've found useful. It's called Carmichael's Imperial Cuticle Cream, and it's a Caswell Massey product. It's a cream. I use it just at night during the wintertime when I'm having trouble, and it helps not only prevent more trouble but cure what trouble I have. And he might try that. I get it through the Vermont Country Store in Weston, Vermont, by mail, but I have seen it in perfume counters and places like that.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Bye.
Just, I guess one thing that I might say, just based on many conversations that I had with dermatologists, just talking about dealing with the problem of dry skin, particularly during the wintertime, is that when you do go and you look for, there are lots and lots of moisturizers that are available over the counter. And I guess the thing that sticks in my mind is the thicker, the better. that often the ones that are the thinnest and they're the easiest to work into your skin, mm-hmm. they have water in them.
Right.
And that's really what you really want is something that's really thicker because it's got really more of the essential moisturizing stuff.
Right.
So, look for the gooeyest stuff is going to be better than this. And of course, the problem is that maybe it's hard to get it on.
Right.
Because it's
so
thick.
You
have to work harder at it. But if you're just applying it to a little area like the cuticle, so maybe, I don't know, get the goopiest stuff that you possibly can. A little Crisco might help. That's Ann Tice. She's been here before. That's one of the stories she likes to tell. Yeah, it's people have told her Crisco. She says, well, okay, if that's what you want to do. Nothing wrong with that. Next caller, Assumption, line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Questioning the benefit of glucosamine chondroitin
mm-hmm.
as a arthritis preventative or improvement in getting rid of those achy knees?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you see benefit from, or what's your opinion?
This is one of those areas, and I hope there are going to be more of them, where some of the over-the-counter supplements may indeed have some significant positive benefit. Glucosamine and chondroitin seem to be helpful in some patients in regenerating some of the cartilage that's damaged in those osteoarthritic knees in particular. And a trial of the supplement over a course of 2 to 3 months is probably not unreasonable. If at the end of that time there isn't any particular benefit noted, there's probably little point in continuing. But I would have to say in my own practice, probably 40% of individuals have seen some noticeable improvement with it, and in that particular setting is probably not unreasonable to continue with it.
Well, what about the dosage?
Generally about 500 milligrams 3 times a day.
Okay. Well, I just wondered if it was a fairy tale or something that...
Well,
or whether it truly was something.
It may indeed. And in fact, there are some long-term, more formal scientific studies being undertaken right now regarding the use of this that may help answer the question, you know, how much, how often, for how long, and who's going to benefit. But
how about side effects?
Generally haven't seen anything related to side effects of any significance.
Okay, I appreciate your thoughts.
All right, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Well, we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time with the promise that Jeff Swearingen will be back again. Now, let's see. I guess that would be in December?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he'll be back here again in December. We'll do it again. Jeff is a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic in Urbana. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.